It's the Brady and the Bunch podcast, presented by 101.3 The Game.
Welcome back. It is the Brady and the Bunch podcast. Very, very excited. This is a very, very special week for us. Very, very excited for us at the station in that on Friday, we're going to be broadcasting the huddle live from the Travis Roy Wiffle Ball Tournament. We do it every single year out at Little Fenway. We'll be broadcasting live 3 to 6, and they call it the best weekend of the year, and it truly is. I mean, the work it takes to put on the Travis Roy Tournament, the teams that come from far and wide, the money raised as we're trying to find cures and research for spinal cord injuries. It's truly a magical weekend. And let's go out to the phone line and find our next guest, a guy who has been a part of every single Travis Roy tournament that there has been. This is going to be year number 18. He's in the Little Fenway Hall of Fame. It's Mario Fontana. Mario, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well as well, and I appreciate you joining us. And let's just start here. 18 years the Travis Roy tournament has been going on. Now, you're from Vermont originally, right? You're not in Vermont now, but you're from here originally?
I am. Born and raised in Vermont. I grew up in Barrie and also spent some time in the Williston area. So we definitely miss it. It is always such a treat to get to go home, especially for the big weekend.
Well, take me back to 18 years ago. 18 years ago, the Travis Roy tournament starts. It's 32 teams this year. I can't imagine it was 32 teams off the bat. How did you even learn about the Travis Roy tournament?
Yeah, my story actually goes a little bit further than 18 years. Pat O'Connor, who, of course, is the originator of all of this tournament and the mastermind, you would say, we became pretty good friends playing boot hockey over at, I think, Letty Park. You know, many, many years ago. And then I was playing with my brother and I met Pat and I was just like, wow, you're just like me, just older. So he's just a real friendly guy. And he ended up inviting me into his fantasy baseball league, which weirdly is still going on today. And one year I had come back from college and Pat said, hey, Mario, I built Little Fenway in my backyard last year. I'm doing a charity tournament. You got to get a team together. And I actually had no idea, because I was away at college, I had no idea that he had actually built Fenway Park in his backyard. I assumed it was just a tall fence. And but Pat's kind of a guy who's hard to say no to. He's got this kind of this charm. It's just tough. And as a 20-year-old kid, I was like, oh, yeah, wiffle ball, that sounds great. And so I got some friends together in last minute, and we showed up for the first tournament. And the story has been told kind of nonstop, but for those who haven't heard it, it was just kind of a one-day affair. There were only 7 teams who signed up to play. It was very rainy. Pat's field did not have near the expert drainage that it did, so it ended up being a pretty muddy day. And it was just Fenway, but, the field was incredible. I'd never seen anything like it. And, you know, I think there's such a thing as love is first sight for things that don't have to deal with, lifelong partners, right? I guess maybe the Little Fenway could be a lifelong partner in this case, but, I just was blown away. And, the first game, we played the first game, and it was this really cool, kind of back and forth game. I remember it ended up being 8-8, and the game went to extra innings, and the game was running so long they were worried that, you know, we're way behind schedule. And so this kind of snap decision was made to take the tie game to a home run derby, and I actually hit the home run that ended up winning the game. And I think from that moment on, I was hooked. Like, I was bought in 100%. I was just like, this is going to be a part of my life for as long as it's a thing. Cause it was just so much fun. And, you know, I was a kid, you know, I grew up in Barrie and, you know, I played sports and I was a fine athlete, but I never really was able to play on any teams, in team sports that did particularly well. And so this was kind of an outlet for me to be super competitive or, you know, kind of keep my competitive nature and maybe be a little bit more competitive. And, because, like, I don't know, I just never played on many great teams growing up. And so all those things kind of combined to get me roped in. Now, obviously, things are much different now. The tournament's huge. There's two additional fields. There is a huge fundraising component that wasn't there the first year. I think the first year it was just raised something like $4,000, and I think last year was closer to $650,000. So to see the growth is amazing, and to think that this has been 18 years, and approaching half of my lifetime, that's pretty special. So it's great.
What does the tournament mean to you overall?
That's such a sideline reporter question, right? I think that the tournament has really shifted in my life in terms of the meaning. And I say that because I think, as I just alluded to, when I started playing, it was really about the chance to compete, the chance to do this really unique thing. Like Travis says this a lot, but there's a lot of fundraisers out there. Yeah. You know, golf tournaments are a dime a dozen, and everyone's doing bar events. This is kind of the only kind of annual thing that's unique. Like, there's nothing like it. And there have been imitators out there for sure, but nothing has been able to kind of mirror the intense emotions that this tournament kind of portrays. And yeah, from a wiffle skill standpoint, I think there are wiffle ball tournaments out there that kind of have more talented, more talented players, but none of them play 9 versus 9 and kind of play it like a baseball game, which is really amazing. So, you know, I think the first thing that you get hooked on is competing and playing and kind of like how incredible that is. But I can't speak for everybody, but I think this is a common theme. I think as you get to do it more and more, it becomes less about the competition and more about the people. And it's really two groups of people. It's the people on your team, and it's the people you meet while you're there. And it's not just the other players, too. It's the volunteers. It's the people like Sue Bentledge and Bruce Bosley and Jane O'Neill and all these people who you see, and they keep coming back, and they keep kind of devoting their summers to planning this tournament. And it's not because they get any benefit out of it other than it's a wonderful event. And so I think you develop a real love for everybody else who's involved with the tournament. And I consider everybody in the tournament kind of part of my extended family. Like, you know, these are people who I would love to have over for Christmas, you know, if they were in town. Or, you know, I've had situations where, you know, I've been kind of living all over the country the last 10 years, but you know, I've met up with people in different states and different towns just because I knew they were going to be there. And that's solely because of this event. And I think that's really special. And the other part is just when you're a kid and you're playing, you kind of establish these teams and they're your friends growing up and people that you've seen your whole life. But as you get to be older, and now I've got two kids and family and a career, this tournament represents the only chance that we have to get together every year. And so it becomes less about the wiffle ball and more about getting in on Thursday and spending 4 days with some of your best friends and family and kind of getting to catch up on the year. And that's really special, too, because it is very easy with everything going on in the world to lose touch with people. And this is an opportunity we have to get together. And, you know, we have a group kind of text thread, and it's always exciting. Like, you know, every May it gets going, and, you know, we start talking about the fundraising. We start talking about all the dumb stuff that's happened over the last 18 years. And, it's just really special. I would not trade it for anything. So, you know, to circle back to the question you asked, I think that what it means to me is it's an opportunity to kind of remember, reflect on how far your life has gone and really be grateful for all that I've been given personally. And this has just been such a blessing to get to be involved every year and have a reason to go to Vermont. You know, that's just, I don't have to pitch it. My wife knows we're going to do it, and it's just really great.
Well, always important to get the wives on board, so I'm glad that she has no problem coming up. And, you know, Mario, it was 2 years, I guess 3 years ago now, actually, that I first got my first look at Little Fenway, and it wasn't even for the Travis Roy tournament. It was for another auxiliary wiffle ball tournament. I got to just see the fields and see the environment, and I was so impressed. And then it was a few months later that I got to see the Travis Roy tournament in action for the first time, and I was really blown away. As someone who was getting kind of ingratiated into a new community, and someone who's a diehard baseball fan, it kind of hit me on all levels that I wanted to be a part of this. But again, as you were there from the beginning, and you've seen it grow from, as you said, seven teams to now 32, what was it like on a year-to-year basis just to see this thing grow in real time?
That's a really interesting question. I think, you know, Pat has a lot of people he leans on. And I'm just one of many. But I think he and I always had a vision to see where this could go. Now, I certainly was not in there convincing him to build extra fields. I think that was – so Little Wrigley was – I helped with many people. I was lucky enough to get to help kind of see that field kind of built, because I missed Fenway getting built, but like I was there for Wrigley and, you know, helping with, you know, digging the post holes for the wall and putting in the cement and putting up the plywood and all that stuff. And I think when Pat kind of took that step to add an additional field, I think that's when it maybe exceeded my greatest expectations. For the first, I want to say, 5 years, it was just Fenway. And, you know, I'm not saying just Fenway. Fenway is wonderful. But you were always going to be limited as to what you could do. And especially because you could always add more teams, but then if you're jamming the schedule too tight, number one, you know, there's going to be issues with timing, and two, if there's any sort of weather, and every year it always seems to rain at least one of the days, then you're kind of in danger of pushing things back. But when Pat kind of took the step to build another field, which, by the way, is not a cheap endeavor,
yeah,
that is when I really maybe realized that this was getting pretty special and out of control is not the right word, but maybe controlled chaos. You know, I actually remember the year that they first decided to put lights on the field. And that was kind of this, I think the first couple of years, you know, it was just, we were just working with daylight. And then all of a sudden Pat said, well, you know, I could get someone to donate those, the lights they use for construction on the interstate in some states, like they're used by a gas generator.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden just like, well, now we can go to 16 teams. And then when he added the new field, it was like, well, now we can go to 24 teams. And all this is funny because Travis's original suggestion was just like thinking, oh, I was thinking maybe we could just put up a snow fence and some bases. I was not expecting you to create a whole nother, you know, field. So, but that's Pat in a nutshell. And I think, because Pat has this really incredible imagination, you know, maybe he's like a weird version of Willy Wonka. I just have learned to accept that there is no real limit that this could go to, with the exception of whatever constraints are in the way. Now, as it turns out, the constraints we really do face are just having enough volunteers. It takes a lot of time and effort, and it's not so much, you know, the area as it is. When you build fields, then you need more people to help tend to the fields and do things like announce the games and keep score and rake the field. So, but by and large, 2007 was when it really got pretty crazy. And, you know, as maybe it's kind of an easy segue, that's also the year that I think teams realized that they could do a lot more. In terms of how much money could be raised, that, you know, for the first 5 years or so, the money raised really was just tied into the teams coming in, and there was a team fee at the time, and teams would bring in some money and fundraise. It's not like that wasn't happening, but 2007 in particular, a team from Massachusetts called the Boston Terriers came in, and it's this guy Tom Sleeper and his two kids and all their friends, and they brought in an astronomical dollar amount of money. They had held a fundraiser, and I think it was $30,000.
Wow.
Just something unbelievable. And that told a lot of the teams, just like, we could all do more. And that is when the tournament really exploded, because rather than expand the tournament and try and raise more money just based on bringing more teams in, it became, let's see if we can all become better fundraisers. So that component really, I think, made the tournament what it was today. The tournament of the first 5 years in no way resembles what we have today, not just because of the fields, but because of the attitude that the players have based around that fundraising. And honestly, if that had not happened and teams just kind of came in and paid their team fees and did kind of a modest amount, I'm not sure that the tournament would have survived to what it is today, because I'm not sure that that would keep all the volunteers coming back. Because at the end of the day, I think all of us as volunteers are driven by the fact that this tournament is raising a lot of money and there's a lot of people who are getting real help. It's been amazing, and I think now that I don't live in Vermont, I think what's most fun is, oh man, what is Pat gonna do this year to kind of up the ante? I remember the year that he added a light up Sitco sign. That was like 2011 or 12,
wow.
And like that was crazy. And then somebody came in and donated this whole patio that kind of sits on a hill where you could watch all three fields at once. And this year, they had the idea to create a brick walkway, and you can buy a brick and have your name inscribed on it. And I mean, it's
so
insane.
Cool.
I mean, anything that you could imagine happening at this tournament seems to happen at this tournament. I mean, the games are broadcast on a live internet feed now. That's crazy.
How long did it take you to kind of learn the full story of Travis Roy? Because as you mentioned, those first 5 years, the fundraising was not as big a part of it. Was that because it took a while to get the Travis Roy story and its impact out there? Like, how long did it take you to realize, wow, this is bigger than just competition and fun?
I think that's a good question. I mentioned the Terriers coming in with a big amount. The real driver for all of this was this woman named Kim Trahan, who in year three, the Comets Express, they're from Massachusetts as well. And that was, again, the tournament was very competition driven and just kind of this fun thing. But Kim had this wonderful idea. Kim has since passed away kind of really sadly. She's a wonderful woman and her son's still playing the tournament. And she said, okay, you know, we're raising money, but we can do more than this. And she just went door to door in her neighborhood, and she got her neighbors all to donate money to the cause. And that year the Comets showed up and they brought it was a nice amount. It was more than we raised the original tournament. It must have been $5,000 or so.
Hmm.
And I think she raised like $2,100 of that or something. So that was kind of the first step that, where people could kind of realize, hey, this can be more than us just coming up and paying our money and buying the food and bidding on stuff at the silent auction. But I don't think that happened and everyone just said, oh, great, now we're all good fundraisers. It's been really incremental. For me personally, I read Travis's book. Like, I knew that the money was going somewhere important.
Yeah.
But I think I read Travis's book in maybe the fourth or fifth year, 2005 or six. I think I won it. I think I won a home run derby, and my prize was a plaque in Travis's book. And I read the book, and I was just like, that's when it hit me. That's when I really understood where Travis was coming from. And that's when I started taking things a lot more seriously and stopped thinking about myself so much and how the tournament affected me and more about how the tournament affected other people. I think the other thing, you know, for people who maybe, you know, aren't avid readers, is 1 year, must have been 2007. So again, that fifth year was really critical. We had this really great idea to, why don't we take a picture of everybody who's at the tournament? So let's make it mandatory for everybody to be at the field at 2:30 on Saturday and take a group photo. And then we'll also use this time to kind of announce how much money was raised. And so all of a sudden, this thing, which didn't exist in the first 5 years, has now become probably one of the most important parts of the weekend, where we are all getting together and kind of announcing how much money is raised. And so that becomes very moving. And then as a part of that, somebody will come in and either talk about the research. It used to be that there was no hope for people who had spinal cord injuries. Doctors would be like, yep, you're stuck in this chair for life. And now the message is very different. Now the message is something is going to happen and we're going to be able to fix this problem, but it's going to be just a matter of time and money. And so every year, in addition to kind of feeling good about the money that you raised, you also start to hear stories about, okay, this is the research that I'm doing, and we're close to getting people in chairs use of their hands and bowels. Like, that doesn't seem like a big thing, except when you don't have use of your hands and bowels, all of a sudden it becomes a big deal. And just improving quality of life. And so I think that becomes very moving. And I think, you know, as an extension, you don't want to let everyone else down, because you have people there who are getting recognized for doing really wonderful work with the fundraising, and you want to be a part of that too. You don't want to be that guy who doesn't get recognized. The last thing that I didn't talk about this is we have individual awards for fundraising, which also I think was established in 2007. That 2007 kind of becomes this really critical year for forming the tournament as we know it today. Because as I alluded to, Wrigley happens and this team from Boston comes in with just an extraordinary amount of money. And they establish these 20, 20, 30, 30, 40, 40 clubs. So, real simply, 20, 20 would be 20 people who donate $20 or more. 30, 30 would be 30 people who donate $30 or more, and so forth. And that becomes really important because everybody who gets that status gets recognized. And so, you know, you get your name called out and you get either like a wristband or a pair of socks. So it serves two purposes. One, everybody there knows that you're working hard at the fundraising and not just coming in to play wiffle ball, right? So you are, this is more than just you coming in to compete. This is you coming in to help the cause. And so, you know, there's probably that peer pressure of, well, I don't want to look like someone who doesn't care about the cause. But number two, I think those are all really meaningful things. There are people who are, and certainly some in our tournament, who are lucky enough to have people who you can ask for $500 and they can just give it to you,
yeah.
Right? Or maybe they have, maybe they work for a company that will just cut you a $1,000 check. And, you know, is that more meaningful than someone who literally reaches out to everybody they know and asks to help, right? Like, whether or not they say yes or no. Like, I would argue that even though the money is important and, you know, the more money that you raise, the more people can be helped, I think there's just a lot of meaning in being somebody who can reach out and get out of your comfort zone a little bit and go and harass some friend, you know could donate $20. And so I think that's when it really exploded for everybody too, because there is a way to kind of show everybody, hey, I'm putting effort into this. I wasn't just somebody who, you know, had a rich, you know, a rich uncle who donated a lot of money. I got a lot of people to donate. And so that has been really big. And I can say personally that you don't want to show up at Little Fenway and not have your bona fides in order. This is maybe kind of embarrassing to admit, but I literally every year will have a stress dream where I dream that I have come to Little Fenway for the tournament and I have forgotten to fundraise. Like, that's a real thing that happens to me. And it's not because you know, I feel like, oh, other people are going to laugh at me. It's because I don't want to let Travis down. Like, you know, Travis is a friend. He's somebody who over 18 years I've gotten to know, and we talk, you know, when the tournament's not happening, and I just don't want to let him down. You know, I want Travis to see that I care about him and I care about the people he's trying to help, and I'm going to do whatever I can within my ability to make a difference.
You know, we talk to Travis Roy every year on our show. Again, we're doing our show from the tournament on Friday. We'll talk to Travis again. Day to day, it's tough to be Travis Roy, and he has told us how hard
it is for him on a day-to-day basis to live with what he's living with. But for this one weekend tucked in Jericho, Vermont, what does this weekend mean to him? Because I'm sure he does a great job at telling the volunteers and telling the people of this tournament just how important it is.
Yeah, Travis is, he's very special to me. You know, I don't want to speak for other people, but I think that this is universal in that, you know, he's our leader in this, and he is somebody for whom, when you have a spinal cord injury, it is so easy to lock yourself away from the world, right? It's hard to get out there. Even if you have access to the right equipment, the wheelchairs and the vans and you know, all of those sorts of things, there is kind of this really unfair shame that comes with not being able to do things for yourself, even when it's not your fault. And so to see Travis as somebody, and again, this comes from reading his book. His book really helped me get into his mindset for this, and then getting to know him in the meantime has helped even more. But so to see somebody who's willing to put himself out there, you know, last year he did this really, really great video that he passed out to all the teams where he was kind of demonstrating how somebody in a wheelchair doesn't get to run the bases and go out there and field. And it was very lighthearted and funny, but also kind of sobering, right, to remember that there are people out there who don't get to, you know, swing a bat and don't get to try and, you know, crush one off the Green Monster or over the Green Monster. So that's very humbling. And I think Travis is, number one, a reminder of that, but number two, somebody who has dedicated his life to this. And it's moving. I get teary-eyed every year, you know, not talking to Travis necessarily, but getting there and reflecting on what's been done and all these people who've come together to help. And, you know, the one thing the Travis Roy tournament does, Tom Downs, who's also another lifer who's been in this from the start, he has frequently remarked that the tournament kind of restores your faith in humanity.
Yeah.
And it's true. There's a lot of bad stuff going on out there. Just this weekend, we had two mass shootings. And with everything that's going on politically and how divided things seem to be happening in our nation, this is something that can help you remember that there is good in people, and there are good people out there who are trying to make a difference. And it charges me up and reminds me to be a better person. And also reminds me to not take things for granted myself. Because this could happen to any of us. Any one of us could get into some accident where all of a sudden we're stuck in a chair. And that shouldn't have to happen to anybody. So if that day does come, hopefully the research will be far enough along that doesn't have to be a life sentence.
Mario, what means more to you when you see a new team come in or when you see the same team come back every year?
That's a really good question. I think they both offer different things, and I'm not one to rank very
yeah.
much. So I will say that both have a lot of meaning. I think, to the first point, you know, I know what to expect now, and so one of my favorite thing is to see, sometimes we'll have a new team member because, you know, invariably the same 10 or 12 guys can't make it every year because life, not everyone is a psychopath like me who can kind of build their summer around this tournament, which is exactly what I do every year. I kind of block out when the tournament is and plan the rest of my summer around that. But not everybody can do that, and not everybody, you know, like necessarily has other people in their lives who understand that that's a big thing and to not expect you to be available. But it is really fun to see someone experience what I experienced and kind of seeing the place for the first time and see their eyes grow really big and it's so overwhelming. And that's I mean, you never want anybody to be overwhelmed. That's not a good thing, but it is really cool to see everybody kind of have that experience. And I like that. And I like that for new teams. And I like it. Like, we have a team from Alabama now. Like, that's fantastic. It has been such a joy to see them, you know, get to get to learn the lay of the land. And, you know, you can always tell who the new people are because of how excitedly they're talking to everybody, and they just can't believe it. But the other thing that's pretty special is to see people grow and see people who kind of come back. You know, there's two ways you can go with this tournament. Some people go, they experience it, and it's like, oh, that was a cool thing, and they might come back one or two more years, but it's not necessarily something that moves them, and that's okay. Like, not everybody is going to be so invested in this. But what's more special is the people who come in maybe a little bit skeptical or just come in to play the wiffle ball and then have that same experience that I was just describing of understanding Travis, understanding all these wonderful people who are being very selfless and growing to themselves become more selfless and become better fundraisers and become better sports. We certainly have had people who have come in and maybe taken the competition a little bit too seriously. And I don't want to sound like I am not very competitive, because I'm definitely one of the most competitive people that I know. But to see people who can kind of develop that ability to just take a step back and laugh at themselves when they strike out, or not get bent out of shape when a bad call is being made. And then, of course, to become better fundraisers. And to, you know, I'll tell a personal story. The first year that they said they're going to have teams fundraise, I got super mad. And I'm not proud of this, but, you know, I was 21 years old. I just had gotten out of college. I was barely making ends meet at my job. And I was like, what? I have to, you know, get together this team fee to pay for, and now you're asking me to ask other people for money. And I just didn't understand why that money was important, right? And that's because I was 21. You know, I was a kid. I didn't understand, you know, the reason behind that. So, and eventually I understood it. So for me, I take great joy in seeing teams come back and teams really buy into the fundraising. And all of a sudden, teams that were barely raising $2,000 raise $5,000 and $6,000 and $7,000 and $10,000. Like, that is special, because that means that people are understanding that to be selfless. And that's probably one of the most important things I think you can do as a human being.
What's the craziest thing you've ever done to fundraise?
So everybody's got different ways they fundraise. And some people can reach out to a network, and some people, like, you know, they'll have kind of these recurring events every year. It's like, okay, you're doing your basketball tournament this year. That's great. And that's really the best way to fundraise, because it is hard to ask people for money. And so if they feel like they're getting something back, then that is kind of an easier sell, you know, to ask for their $40 or whatever it is. Because I have two young children, I don't at this point in my life have the bandwidth. Oh, and we just moved here to Western New York, so I don't have the network yet to have one of those events. And so
that's why you just use your kids. You just use your kids because they're cute and they're kids, and you just go up to them and say, hey, wouldn't you like to help out someone like me? And you let them do it for you.
Yeah, well, we're getting to that point. And okay. Believe me, I am not above using my kids as props, which I'll get to in a second. So what I do currently is I have a theme every year, because if I'm going to come back and ask the same people to donate and hopefully get, you know, 10% new people or whatever, I don't have set target goals, but I want to give them something back. And one thing is I write this very, what I think is a very funny Christmas letter every year. So if you are one of my donors, you get on my Christmas letter list. And I personally think that's worth the price of admission, because it is just, I don't like, look, I'm happy if you send me your Christmas card with your family, and I'll put it on my wall, but, like, that's, I don't think that's very creative. And, you know, some people might say, I don't want to see your snot-nosed kid on my wall, right? I'm not that person, but other people might say that. But for me, I have this letter. And number one, if you want to know what's up with the family, I'll tell you in the letter. Number two, if you want to have a laugh and, you know, hear me poke fun of myself, you know, you'll hear that too. So I give them that. But number two is I try and give them something else. And this year, like, one year, my daughter, I'm looking at it now, she was three, and for Father's Day, I got this list from her of my dad's superpowers, and so the teacher would ask her, you know, what the answer is. So it's like, tell me something that he's really good at. Tell me something that he makes really well. And so she's like, well, he makes really good pancakes, and you know, he likes to eat fruits and vegetables, which isn't true, but I appreciate you know, the shout-out.
That's a good lie. Good lie for the teacher.
Yeah. But the funniest thing on there was that he can lift a potato. which just to this day makes me laugh. And so that summer, I themed all these fundraising videos around me lifting potatoes in different ridiculous manners. And people donated and suggested different ways I could lift a potato. This year, I have one on – this is my definitely my best year so far. I have this weird obsession slash enthusiasm for those Little Debbie Christmas tree cakes that they have every December. And this goes back a long ways. My grandmother used to have them at her house, and so that is a very fond memory for me. And I'm a bit of a glutton, and I like sweets. So I was quite delighted when Little Debbie kind of released a limited run this summer of the Christmas tree cakes in July. And so I have built my whole fundraising campaign about that. And this year, if you donate to me $20 or more, you can come up with any ridiculous way you want for me to eat a tree cake. And there's been some good ones. One person made me hang it from a chandelier and have to jump up and try and eat it. One person said I had to try and eat four in 30 seconds, which did not go well. I did not succeed.
Did you throw up, though? You know, that's the question.
One person, one of my best friends, had me reenact the climactic scene from the movie Over the Top, starring Sylvester Stallone, and so I was arm wrestling a tree cake, which was hilarious. So there is no shameful thing that I won't go to raise money for this. Next year, I think I want to I want to get enough donations that I dress up as a professional wrestler, and the more money I raise, I will wear less. So if I get to $5,000, I'll wear just like the Speedo and the boots for the weekend. So that's what I'm kicking around. I have to see if I can come up with something, you know, that is incentive for people. But you know, I think when you are doing this for this long, and now I've kind of been seriously fundraising for 12 or 13 years. You have to come up with different ways, number one, to amuse yourself, because it kind of is tedious to send out the same email every year. But number two, to kind of let your donors know that you give a crap about this. And I really do, and I want them to know that I'm not doing this just because I have to. Like, I think you start fundraising, and I think you just do it for that kind of very external, extrinsic motivation of either I want to do better than the next person, or I don't want to look like a fool when I show up with no money. But now it's something different. I'm doing this because I get great satisfaction. Like, when I look at my totals and I see all the hard work I put into it, I feel really good about myself. And I feel like I've really done everything I can to make the world a better place in whatever small way I can. And so if that means me looking or feeling a little bit foolish, great, I'm going to do it.
Well, Mario, we'll get you out of here momentarily. You seem to have a lot of clout at Little Fenway and with this tournament. So my only suggestion, can we expand it so we can use the little red Fred Flintstone bat rather than the slender yellow one? Because the slender yellow one, that's pretty tough to hit with, Mario. I'm trying to go deep, too.
Yeah. Well, you know, I would say that money always talks at the Travis Roy Wiffle Benefit.
And, okay.
If you pitch to somebody that you'll make a donation if you can use the Bammer bat, I think if you talk to the right person, you can make that happen.
Are you the right person?
No, I'm not that person. Well, I think it depends.
I
think you got to get in the ear of somebody at the field. The umpire, right, might be a good person to talk to.
If I donate money to your cause, I will not put down a tree cake request in exchange for a better bat.
I think I can make that happen. I think that's I do have some clout, and I think we can make that happen.
Well, Mario Fontana has been to every Travis Roy tournament that there has been. This is year number 18. It's coming up this weekend. It's aptly named the best weekend of the year. People come from far and wide. You mentioned yourself coming from Western New York after growing up in Vermont as well. We look forward to seeing you. We appreciate the work of you and every team member, every volunteer, everyone at the Travis Roy tournament. We'll see you out there this weekend also, Mario. Thank you for the time. Thank you for all you do.
Thank you. I can't wait.